Chapter 60. Police Corruption. In January 1728, a play called The Beggar's Opera became the rage of London. It was written by John Gay and presented by a manager called Rich. It made Gay rich and Rich gay. What the audiences found so piquant about it was that it was not about tragic kings and queens, but about thieves, highwaymen, prostitutes and fences. The villain, Peachum, is a receiver of stolen goods who supplements his income by handing over some of his customers to the law. In essence, it was an amusingly realistic portrayal of crime and corruption in 18th-century London. Only 3 years earlier, Londoners had crowded to watch the execution of the man who served as the model for Peachum, the thief-taker Jonathan Wilde. In fact, Wilde may be regarded as the archetype of the crooked cop. He wasn't a cop. Officially, the British police force didn't come into existence until the end of the 18th century, but he was regarded as a valuable ally of the law. Arriving in London in about 1710, at the age of 22, Wilde quickly made the discovery that the man who makes most out of crime is not the thief, but the man who finances him. At this time, there was an extraordinary loophole in the law. A receiver of stolen goods could not be prosecuted. Wilde set up as a receiver, and soon became so prosperous that he was able to buy an inn. By the time an Act of Parliament changed the law on receivers, he had already devised a way to operate legally. He would approach men who had been robbed and offer to buy the stolen goods back from the thief for a small commission. This was so successful that he set up a shop where people who had been burgled could come to inquire about their property. For 5 shillings, Wilde would enter their names on his books, and then a few days later, in exchange for a reward, he would restore the goods. The peace officers employed by the City of London had no objection. Wilde was one of their best informers. And so long as he helped to send highwaymen and thieves to the gallows at Tyburn, they didn't really care what he did. Wilde would probably have died comfortably in his bed if he hadn't overreached himself. He organised some of the robberies himself. Business was so good that he had to store some of the stolen property in warehouses. Jealous confederates finally betrayed him. The law had to act. In May 1725, he was taken to Tyburn, now Marble Arch, in a cart, and pelted and jeered at by the mob. And there he was hanged on a triangular gallows. It was probably his reputation for betrayal rather than dishonesty that prompted the crowd's hostility. Wilde's system and methods have been copied many times since then, in America and on the continent, as well as in this country, wrote a biographer of Jonathan Wilde in 1937. This was not quite true. Before you can have large-scale official corruption, you must first have a flourishing crime industry. In the London of Jonathan Wilde, the crime rate was very nearly as high as in present-day New York, and for a rather odd reason. In the middle of the 17th century, a Dutch professor named Sylvius discovered how to distill a powerful spirit from juniper berries. It was called genièvre, French for juniper, and then shortened to gin. The English had always been beer and wine drinkers, but when William of Orange became king in 1689, Dutch gin began to flow into England. In 1690, an Act of Parliament allowed anyone to brew and sell spirits without a licence. Thousands of gin shops opened up, and the sign, "Drunk for a penny, dead drunk for tuppence, straw free," became commonplace. The crime rate rocketed, and men, like Wilde, flourished. He was the most notorious crooked cop of his time, but there were dozens of others. Gin, crime, and crooked peace officers went together. However, it's not accurate to talk about police corruption. It's seldom the uniformed man on the beat who gets corrupted. In all the major police scandals, from the trial of the detectives in London in 1877 to the widely publicised Knapp Commission hearings in New York in 1971, the culprits have been plainclothes detectives. There was even a certain amount of corruption among the famous Bow Street runners, the forerunners of the modern London police force. These ununiformed detectives were known for their high living, and at least two of them left fortunes of over £20,000. That kind of money is not made by honest thief-catching. But the detective has to spend part of his days in contact with crooks because his job is to obtain information. When he's dealing with small-time crooks, the temptation is small, But the big-time crook can offer enormous bribes, and his success lends him a certain aura of sophistication and authority that may induce a sense of inferiority in the detective earning less than £2,000 a year. As if these pressures are not enough, the detective may be induced to compromise himself and then be blackmailed. All three of these factors were at work in the events which led to the London police scandals of 1877. The crooks in this case were two highly successful confidence swindlers named Kerr and Benson. Both had mastered the art of seeming to be rich men. Benson, with an excellent French accent, played the part of an aristocrat. Kerr appeared to be a bluff country gentleman who might have stepped out of the pages of a novel by Anthony Trollope. Their chosen field was sport, and their method of swindling had a certain classic simplicity and originality. Benson, who was living in luxury at Shanklin on the Isle of Wight under the name of Young, wrote a letter to the Comtesse de Goncourt explaining that he was a brilliantly successful sportsman. As a result, he said, bookmakers always shortened the odds when he backed a horse, knowing that it was almost certain to win. All that he wanted of the Comtesse de Goncourt was that she should act as his agent and place bets on horses for him. He would send her the money, and when the horse won, she would post him his winnings, upon which he would pay her a 5% commission. The Comtesse could see no harm in this arrangement, and she forwarded the cheque to a bookmaker. Now, in fact, the bookmaker was Benson himself. Soon she received a cheque for £1,000 from the bookmaker, Benson's winnings. She forwarded the cheque to Benson, who promptly sent her £50 for her trouble. Naturally, the Comtesse wanted to invest some of her own money in the apparently foolproof scheme, and she gave Benson and his accomplice, Kerr, £10,000 over a short period. She was only one of their victims. So how did Scotland Yard detectives come to be involved with these swindlers? Well, the full story is unknown, but the first one to accept the bribe seems to have been Detective Inspector Micklejohn of the Yard. Micklejohn was a friend of a man called Druskovich, who was in charge of the Continental branch of the fraud squad. Druskovich got himself into some extraneous financial trouble and urgently needed £60. Micklejohn introduced him to a perfect gentleman who persuaded Druskovich to accept the £60 as a present. The gentleman was Kerr. Micklejohn's boss, Clark, was then drawn into the web by the aristocratic Benson. Benson sent him a message claiming to have information about a gang that Clark had recently broken up. He explained that he was too crippled to leave his home on the Isle of Wight and could Clark call on him. Benson had previously crippled himself in an attempt to commit suicide in jail by setting fire to his mattress. This was good psychology. Clark went to the palatial home at Shanklin and was introduced to the exquisitely dressed gentleman who lay on a couch and whose handkerchiefs had coronets embroidered on them. Benson explained that he was afraid that Clark was about to be blackmailed. Rumours were circulating that he had taken bribes from the gang he had recently broken up. Clark said indignantly that he had never taken bribes. Of course not, Benson agreed, silkily. But unfortunately, there was a letter that Clark had written to one of the gang, arranging a secret meeting. Perhaps it was all police business, but it certainly read very suspiciously. Finally, Clark was not so much blackmailed as charmed and dominated. When a fourth yard man, Detective Inspector Palmer, was drawn into the circle, the swindlers felt that they were ready to face the world. And very soon they had to. Benson decided that it was time for a grand coup. He told the trusting Comtesse de Goncourt that he had a superb opportunity to invest £30,000 for her. It would bring a huge return. The Comtesse did not have that much in ready cash, so she consulted her lawyer, a man named Abrahams. Abrahams was instantly suspicious, and he checked with Scotland Yard on Mr. Young of Shanklin. Druskovich instantly warned Benson that the Comtesse's lawyer had smelled a rat. The conspirators launched into action. They hadn't expected to be discovered quite so soon. The loot, well over £10,000, was drawn out of the Bank of England. But in a transaction of that size, the numbers of the notes were known. It would have excited suspicion to ask for the money in old, used notes. The police reached the bank soon after the cash had gone, and Druskovich was ordered to telegraph the numbers of the notes to all banks in the British Isles. He conveniently overlooked Scotland. which gave Benson time to get to Glasgow and to change this marked money into £100 notes on the Bank of Clydesdale, which had the advantage of being unnumbered and the disadvantage of being difficult to change outside Scotland. Duly, the detectives were all given their rewards, Micklejohn receiving £500. However, he acted stupidly. He changed one of the notes with a wine merchant in Leeds in Yorkshire. The Leeds police soon found out that a Scotland Yard man had changed a Clydesdale note, and they wrote to another of Druskovich's superiors, Williamson, at the Yard. Druskovich intercepted the letter and burned it. The Clydesdale notes were proving to be more trouble than they were worth. Benson went to Rotterdam and cashed one at a hotel. The Dutch police promptly arrested him. Druskovich informed the other swindler, Kerr, who sent a cable to the Dutch police, signed Williamson, Druskovich's immediate superior, ordering them to release their captive. They almost did so, but decided to wait for confirmation by letter, which failed to arrive. Ironically enough, Druskovich was then sent to Rotterdam to bring Benson back. He was in a gloomy mood. He realised that the net was closing in on him and on his confederates. Within a short while, Kerr was also arrested, and he and Benson were tried. Benson got 15 years, Kerr 10. They then decided that their bent cops had not lived up to their side of the agreement in allowing them to get caught, and in retaliation they denounced them. The result was the trial of the detectives, which shook the English middle class to its foundation. If its members couldn't trust the renowned British bobby, who could they trust? The feeling in favour of the police was so strong that Clark was actually acquitted. The other three were put inside for 2 years. The two swindlers were also satisfied. Their sentences were reduced by a third. Benson later committed suicide after a spectacular swindle practised on Adelina Patti, the Spanish-born coloratura who appeared in concerts in New York from 1850, by jumping from a high gallery in an American prison where he had ended up. The scandal created by the trial of the detectives indicates how strongly the British trust their policemen. And statistically, they're right to do so. Britain has never suffered from the presence of major crime. Its murder rate is still one of the lowest in the world. Where there are no large pickings to be made from such activities, there is unlikely to be undue police corruption. In the Scotland Yard affair, only Micklejohn had the makings of a really dishonest official. In the United States, however, graft has always been so widespread, starting with the local city halls, that police corruption is accepted with habitual resignation. From the beginning, the United States had the raw material, the wide open spaces and the vitality that makes for enormous wealth. Violence, together with the opening of the frontiers, was a way of life. In the original Wild West, the distinction between robbers and lawmen was likely to get blurred. In fast-growing towns such as Chicago and San Francisco, the same thing was true. And there it was actively encouraged by the Horatio Alger Protestant ethic of success, which is so basic to American society. Any society which attaches so much importance to wealth and gain is asking for corruption. One of the first big inquiries into police corruption in New York was in 1893, inspired by the Reverend Charles Parkhurst, who had discovered that practically every member of the police force had paid contributions to Tammany Hall, for the privilege of getting his job. One police captain had handed out $15,000 for his rank. Where did he get the money? From the keepers of gambling houses and brothels. The police chief, Alexander S. Williams, had shares in a brewery and forced saloon owners to sell his whiskey on penalty of being raided. Williams was unable to explain how he had managed to afford an estate on Long Island, complete with a yacht and its own dock, on his police salary. Although no charges were made against him, he resigned a year later. Understandably, then, a deep-seated distrust of the law is part of American life, particularly among oppressed racial and religious minorities. Herbert Asbury, historian of New York gangs, records that in race riots at the turn of the 20th century, usually started by white youths, the police would join in on the side of the whites, battering the Negroes with their clubs and arresting them. From 1894 onwards, there have been major investigations into police corruption about every two decades. In New York, the most recent of these was the Knapp Commission of 1971. In spite of the sensational nature of the revelations, The hearings excited little coast-to-coast attention. The final report, which came out in December of 1972, colourfully divided bent cops into meat-eaters and grass-eaters. Meat-eaters are policemen who aggressively misuse their power for personal gain. The grass-eaters simply accept the payoffs that come their way. The vast majority of corrupt policemen, said the report, are grass-eaters. In an area like New York's Harlem, with its illegal gambling, a bent cop could make $1,500 a month. If he was transferred to another command, this payment would continue for another 2 months, giving him time to adjust to his lower income. It could explain how, when the police seized heroin, it was likely to find its way back into the drugs market. And how, of $137,000 seized from drug traffickers, $80,000 went into the pockets of the arresting officers. In one police precinct, over 68 pounds of French Connection heroin had vanished from the police laboratory, $7 million worth at current prices then. The figures poured out regularly, but no one was very shocked or very surprised. Americans had heard it all before. They expected their police to behave like that. They might be roused to protest occasionally if the misbehaviour became too public, as when Mayor Daley's Chicago policeman was seen on television beating up anyone who looked like a demonstrator during the Democratic Convention of 1968. But generally speaking, the feeling is that the police have got a tough job and that a little brutality and corruption is inevitable, if not occasionally necessary. There is something to be said for this attitude. England had an average of 3 murders a week in 1971. The United States had a murder every 33 minutes, and the figures show no sign of declining. With violence on this scale, toughness is regarded as a basic necessity in a policeman or in a prison guard. Unless there's some occur. When Tom Merton became superintendent of the Tucker Prison Farm in Arkansas in 1967, he soon discovered that nearly 200 convicts were listed as having escaped and had never been caught, a far higher number than would have been expected. Seasoned inmates said openly that there were 100 or so bodies buried in the prison grounds, men who, for one reason or another, had fallen foul of the wardens. Merton dug in an area where the ground had sunk and quickly unearthed 3 skeletons. For a few weeks, the scandal drew nationwide headlines, and then suddenly the authorities ordered that there should be no further digging. Merton was dismissed, and the scandal was allowed to simmer. Where tensions have increased, in racially mixed areas in both the United States and in Britain, charges of corruption and brutality against the police have also increased. In September 1973, a detective chief inspector and 5 of his staff were charged at London's Old Bailey with manufacturing evidence of drug smuggling against a Pakistani family. The police were convinced that the family was guilty, but there was not enough evidence against them. The prosecution alleged that the police strengthened the evidence. The father's 5-year sentence was later quashed. The most interesting feature about such a case is that the newspapers scarcely bothered to report it. For the most part, it rated a small paragraph on an inside page. The English public was apparently as blasé about it as the American public was about the New York scandals of 1971. In the words of the lyricist W.S. Gilbert, the policeman's lot is not a happy one. It was true when he wrote it some 100 years ago. Unhappily, it is truer than ever today.